Well, apparently, Stephanie had reached her ceiling. She was a musical prodigy. She learned piano at age 4. She wrote a piano ballad at 13, and she performed in clubs by the age of 14. She got into Tisch at NYU, but despite all that talent, she still hadn't found a way to make it big. Here's a beautiful song written and performed by Stephanie 10 years ago when she was just 19 years old. In general, as an industry, web workers are subject to three things, right? We generally talk about titles, tools, and outputs. How many people do work on the web in some form? A good portion of it, almost everybody. So when we talk about titles, we talk about things like designer, developer, content strategist, information architect. We use these titles for ourselves, and we sort ourselves into these buckets. It's just kind of cleaner that way. We also talk about the tools that we use, right? So generally, designers use things like Photoshop and Sketch, and content strategists use Google Docs and Excel and Word and things like that. And information architects use tools like OmniGraffle. Now, when you walk by somebody's desk and that person's using OmniGraffle, the likelihood is pretty high that that person is an information architect. But that's kind of odd to make judgments like that. It's like a mild form of racism. It's like OmniGraphalism or something like that. I don't know. We also talk about output, right? So we talk about designers being able to do comps, and developers writing code, and content strategists making documents, and architects making diagrams. But our deliverables, our output, this output, is a little bit too traditional for the squishy, gidgy, icky, responsive design world that we're supposed to be designing for. We have devices that fit in our pockets, and we have browsers that are right outside in Times Square, and we're expected to be able to design for all these things. How many people do responsive design here, or cater to designing and developing for multiple devices? Right, so these output, these tools and these deliverables, they're a bit outdated. Now I want you to think about a little bit of the projects that you've worked on that maybe haven't gone so well. And when you think about it, we've put ourselves in these silos, designer, developer, content strategist, information architect, and so on and more. And the projects that don't go so well, they don't really fall apart within the job descriptions, they kind of fall apart in between. So when the designer-developer handoff doesn't work that well, when the content strategist doesn't do enough to inform the information architect, when we think about silos and we think about where projects fall apart, it's usually in between those things. So a few years ago, I started my own design collaborative called SuperFriendly, and I was determined to find a new set of tools and output that better suit my clients, better suit the people who hire us, and better suit the people that are on my team. So I want to share with you a couple of goals that I had for that. The first was that I was searching for the highest fidelity in the shortest amount of time. Now, the thing that communicates most, and the thing that's very popular nowadays, is to build a prototype. Now, prototypes are really great to make, but sometimes prototypes take weeks and weeks and weeks. They're high fidelity, but sometimes they take a long amount of time. Same thing with comps. You might work on a comp for a week or 2 weeks, but what are some things that you could do that have the same amount of fidelity, but maybe take a day or a couple of hours to do? The second thing I want to do is remove abstractions wherever possible. So oftentimes, I don't know if you guys have seen this, but I've seen this many times where present a wireframe to a client, and they say, yeah, everything looks good, this looks awesome. And then I show them the design, and they're like, oh, no, this is terrible, this is awful. And they're like, well, I showed you this stuff in the wireframe, and they're like, oh, we didn't get it. And the reason was because a wireframe is an abstraction of a website or an app or a flow. It's not actually the literal thing. And people, not even us who do these things every day, people have trouble with abstractions. The third thing was that I thought that all deliverables should come with conversations. So oftentimes, what designers and developers do is they'll write code or they'll make comps and they'll send it off to a client and they'll say, it's all self-explanatory, just kind of look in there. And that's not actually true. Sometimes things need explanation. Oftentimes, things need explanation. So in my deliverables for my clients, what I was thinking was, I'm going to free myself from the idea that this stands alone and everything I make is going to come with a phone call. That meant that I had a lot of freedom in trying to make the thing not self-sustainable, but actually explain some of the rationale as to how we were working. And one of the things that I like about this is it led me to the idea of frameworks and not processes. And I want to tell you a little bit about what I mean by that. So this thing here, this is a process. Everybody seen this before? It's Newton's pendulum, Newton's cradle. It's a repeatable system. It's designed for efficiency. It's not designed for innovation. Nothing surprising happens here. So every time you use Newton's cradle, you pull one of the spheres on one end and you let go, and it knocks the other spheres on the other end. Nothing surprising about this. So there's not a point where you're like, where you perform this thing, this task one day, and all of a sudden it like hatches an egg. You're like, whoa, how did that happen? By contrast, though, this is a framework. My friend Mike Lebowitz, who runs an agency called Big Spaceship, he's fond of saying kind of this, that this is more of like a framework. So this is a football field or a soccer field, depending on where in the world you come from. And this, everybody knows the constraints. Everybody knows where out of bounds is. Every game is the same. It's the same amount of time, same amount of players. Everybody knows where the goals are. There's nothing surprising about that. But what happens within those games, that's always surprising every time. Those 90 minutes, that's where star players emerge. That's where trick plays are drawn up. That's where coaches get to be creative about how they defend against the other team. So this is kind of what we should be searching for in our work. We should be looking for frameworks that allow us to innovate rather than processes that we can just repeat every single time. So what I was looking for in my work is a new framework for designers. How many people in this room are designers? A handful. How many people are developers? Now what I mean by designers, so I want to address this because the majority of the room is developers. What I mean by designers are people that are making things, that are trying to render intent. That's my favorite definition of design. It comes from my friend Jared Spool. And he says, design is the rendering of intent. Now sometimes you can render intent through a comp, through pixels. Other times you can render intent through writing code. So what I'm talking about is if you render intent in some way, maybe you render intent to a server, maybe you render intent to a person, maybe you render intent to a boss or to a client or to a colleague. So I want to kind of describe to you what a framework looks like for you. And I consider everybody in this room a designer. So I think the first part of this framework is that designers need to plan more. And I'll show you what I mean by that. One of the first things that designers can be doing more and more of, and that everybody in this room can be doing more of, is interviewing. Now, normally we leave interviews to a researcher or an ethnographer. That's their job. It's not my job as a person who writes code. But this is something that anyone really could do. I worked with a magazine last year, and they were a print magazine, and their print magazine was really great, a beautiful magazine, well art-directed, great editorial, and their website wasn't really up to snuff. So they hired me and my team to redesign the website. What we did before we did anything with them, before we designed, before we wrote any code, before we architected anything, was we just did a bunch of interviews. We interviewed 30 people who read the magazine. Some of them use the website, some of them don't. And we just asked them very casual questions. We didn't have a formal script. We just said, tell us about your experience with the magazine and with this brand. And they told us a ton of things, and we made a PDF deck for about 50 pages or so, which we called Themes and Insights. And what we did was we just wrote one paragraph at the top of the page, a big title in bold letters, and then just wrote quotes from people that support that theme. So as an example, if you look in the top left, what we found was the search browse experience. Everyone browses through the content of the page or searches on the site. No one uses the navigation, right? And we looked at analytics that actually support that. Probably, if you look in the top right, she's obsessed with Pinterest. The reader of this magazine is primarily female. And I would say about 25 of the 30 people that we talked to said that phrase, I'm obsessed with Pinterest. And we found that the majority of people we talked to had Pinterest open while they were browsing the magazine. So what could we do for the site? What kind of ideas does that give us in how we integrate Pinterest into the experience of browsing the site? Probably the biggest thing, if you look in the bottom left, she sees commerce as a service. So one of the things that every reader we talked to, 30 out of 30, said to us was, I would love for this magazine to recommend products to me. Now, if any of you work with advertising or work in advertising, that is a crazy, crazy huge branded content opportunity. And the magazine, they just didn't do it because they thought they didn't want to offend their reader. But all of the readers were saying, we respect this magazine's editorial integrity so much that we trust any product that you would recommend to us and we would go buy it. They were leaving millions of dollars on the table just because they thought to be polite, because they didn't do the research, because they didn't do the interviewing. Now, we didn't have a formal script, we didn't have an ethnographer, we didn't have any of those things. We just talked to people, and we found a multi-million dollar opportunity for them just by talking to people for an hour. Another thing that I think designers could do to plan more is to write manifestos. Now, sometimes you might hear that in different terms, like a creative brief, or a strategic brief, or a communications brief. It's basically the same thing. for me, before I design anything, I write. I write a brief for myself, or I write a brief for the client, just to kind of pare down to me what I'm actually going to be doing. And then when I'm designing something or when I'm coding something, when I run into a problem, I just try to write it out as prose. Rather than trying to bang my head debugging or like just pushing through it, I just put that to the side and just write a couple paragraphs about what I'm doing and what problems I'm having. And oftentimes that creates a solution for me. So I want to tell you about a couple writing tools that help me. How many people have seen this one or know this? This is called OmWriter. OmWriter is fantastic. It is a full screen text editor. I'm sorry, not text editor, a full screen kind of writing program. And it by default opens full screen. You can't have it open next to something else. It takes over your screen. I have dual monitors. It shuts off my second monitor, and it's just blank. And you can pick these like subtle backgrounds. Like my preferred one is a snowscape, but you could pick like a subtle burlap texture or just a blank screen. And you just write. You could even pick like a little ambient soundtrack. But the idea for it is it just to minimize distractions and just let you write. I love this OmWriter. One of the other ones that I use almost religiously is this Notational Velocity. Has anybody used Notational Velocity? It's a great one. This is a fork of it called NV Alt, which supports Markdown, so it lets me write in Markdown. Really, really fast, really lightweight, not a lot of features, syncs to my phone really well, so I have my notes and I have my thoughts everywhere. Anything that I'm doing, this is a restaurant I went to where I did a tasting menu and just wrote down the menu, but anything that inspires me, I'll write down in this tool. This is probably a more popular one, Evernote. Any Evernote users out there? Evernote is great because it lets you organize some of your thoughts. You can collect your thoughts. I'm going to show you a video from my friend Aaron Walter. He's a director of UX at MailChimp. And he talks about how all of MailChimp uses Evernote to inform their manifestos and their creative briefs. Have a look.
We started using Evernote Business very early on, where collecting a lot of feedback from customers, I decided to start forwarding it over to Evernote. I did a quick search, and within a few seconds, I had about 45 pieces of feedback. And then I'd stage that up and start to write a strategy plan. So that was a light bulb moment for me, where I just felt like that's the way it should work.
So what should be in a manifesto? Well, I think the main purpose of a manifesto or a creative brief is to contain creative direction. So what does that mean? What does that look like? I'm not talking about what the colors you use and the typefaces that you use. That's art direction. So what is creative direction? Creative direction is about perspective. Creative direction is about a point of view. Flat design, that's not creative direction. That's not a perspective. That's not a point of view. CSS3, that's not a point of view. Angular, that's not a point of view. Those are things that you can use to execute on creative direction, but you need to know what the actual direction is. So I think most importantly, manifestos say what you're going to do and also what you're not going to do. So in a manifesto, you should say, here's an actual thing that we're going to do, and here's what we're not going to do. So let me give you an example of what that looks like. We're going to play a game. I'm going to show you the main navigation of a site, and I want you to guess as to what that site is. Everybody get that? Okay, pretty simple. Here we go. Okay, what site is this? Just shout it out.
Airbnb.
NYC Tourism.
Time Out.
TripAdvisor.
Lonely Planet.
Any other guesses? Because they're all really great guesses. Time Out New York.
Yeah, Montreal Tourism.
What's that?
Montreal Tourism.
Montreal Tourism, all right. Well, where are you from, sir? Just kidding. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it could be any one of those sites, right? It's hard to tell right now. It's a bit abstract. It can kind of apply to all of those. Now, this shows the lack of perspective, because if you could apply to every site, what makes it specific and so good for one particular site? So let's look at a different navigation for maybe the same site that has a little bit more perspective to it. Ready? Here we go. What site is that?
New York.
City of New York, right? Almost across the board, everybody gets that. And the reason for that is this. My friend Brad Frost wrote an article called Revisiting the Priority Plus Pattern, where he talks about navigation. And he says navigation doesn't just provide wayfinding for users, but also communicates to users what features and services the experience provides. Navigation is branding. Right, so let's look at, if we look at this navigation again, let's look at what a manifesto would have had to say in order to lead to a navigation and architecture like this. New York City is the best city in the world. Let's put front and center what makes it different. We're a fast-paced, globally influential center of art, culture, fashion, and finance. The world takes its cues from us, and our website should reflect that from every angle. That's pretty aggressive in itself, but notice how much of a point of view it has. That navigation could only belong to the city of New York. It wouldn't work for Paris. It wouldn't work for, for Milan. It wouldn't work for Montreal. It wouldn't work for any of those because it's specific to New York. That's what creative direction looks like. What is the thing that's ownable by that brand? What is the thing that's ownable by that organization that you can execute on from every angle, from code, from design, from architecture, from content strategy? What are the things that are really specific to that? A good manifesto and a good creative brief will say that. Do you have a question?
No, a thought.
Yeah.
In a certain sense, when you showed up the banner up top, everybody knows what it was supposed to do. How do you balance off that against confusing people with your special strategy?
Yeah, so how do you balance very specific things with confusion and with sort of patterns? So let me go through a couple of things and I'll come back to that at the end. That's a great question. This article, if you've never written a creative brief before, this is a great article for it. It's called The Magical Short Form Creative Brief. It's written by Jared Spool. It's a fantastic article. I highly recommend reading it. Every time I write a brief, I look at this article before that, just to kind of remind me of what needs to go in it. Definitely worth checking out. By the way, the slides will be available after this talk, so don't feel like you have to capture all the URLs or anything like that. So let's pause for a minute and just talk about what I'm saying. I'm talking about tools for designers, right? Not graphic designers, but designers, people who render intent. And I'm not talking about Photoshop or anything that makes comps or Illustrator, things that you might traditionally think of as what designers should be using. I'm talking about using tools like Notational Velocity and OmWriter and Evernote to do things like interview and write manifestos and briefs. I think these are part of the tool set for a modern designer and what modern designers should be doing and everybody in this room should be doing more and more of. Just because you're a developer doesn't mean you have to just write code and that's it. Just because you're a designer doesn't mean you have to just sit in Photoshop and that's it. Expand kind of your tool set and expand the output that you're making, and that will make you a more well-rounded colleague and individual and professional. Everybody with me so far? All right, let's move on. Step two in the framework. I think designers can be inventorying more. I think that's a big part of what makes for good sites and what makes for good process. So here's an example of an inventory that I love. It's called an interface inventory. My friend Brad Frost did an interface inventory of his bank's website. This is one bank. He just took a screenshot of all the buttons. One bank, right? It looks like, I mean, this looks like he inventoried all the banks on the web, right? Like, it's crazy. But this is one bank. And now this is not because the designers of that bank were incompetent. It's just that there's a bunch of things that kind of happen very specifically and in a vacuum, and sometimes you lose sight of the forest when you're kind of working on the trees. So one thing I suggest, somewhere in the middle of your project, do an interface inventory, because I think it'll help keep you on track. I'll give you another example. My friend Jason Santa Maria designed an app called Editorially. Anybody ever use Editorially? It was a fantastic app. Sadly, they've shut down, but it was a great app for collaborative writing. And Jason is one of the best designers I've ever seen. And this is what he came up with. After kind of stepping back from all the stuff that he had designed, he realized he was all over the map with his button styles and with all those things. So what he did was, after he did an interface inventory, he started to consolidate some of those styles and ended up with something a little bit more like this. Now this was a little bit more cohesive and allowed his developers to be able to create a style guide that looks something like this. Now they have a library that they could use when building everything. So they had this sort of style guide, they had all the variations. And what this did was it actually reduced the number of elements that they were working with, so it helped the team out. It also reduced the amount of elements that a user would interact with, and so it helped reduce the cognitive load and made the interface even clearer for users. So one of the projects that I worked on, I decided to do an interface inventory. I worked on the O'Reilly site. This is the new beta site that's up. You can go to beta.o'reilly.com and see it there. And in the middle of my project, I did an interface inventory. Now, I'm a pretty good designer, I think. But one of the things that I found was I was showing way too many versions of an article. So if you think about that thing on the right side, think of that as like a mobile screen. And think about all the variations of an article. So I was showing a variation of an article with a title only, and a title with an image, and a title with an image and a kicker, and a title with an image and a... 22 variations of an article. Who needs that many variations of an article on a mobile site? So what I did instead was I inventoried all these things, and I sent it to the team. I said, how many of these can we actually get away with? How many of these do we actually need? And we ended up with five, right? So we came up with a list of three definites, you know, a title and a topic and a deck, a title and a topic and a byline and a deck, a title with a type, a byline and a deck, and then we had two maybes. So a title with a topic and a byline, and a title with a type and a byline. And then we showed that to the client, and we said, these are the ways that we can use to show an article. And they were like, yeah, that sounds good. So doing an interface inventory will just sort of help you get on track and really make you cognizant of all the things that you're working on. One of my other favorite types of inventories is performance budgets, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that. I did a project last year for an organization called Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Has anybody ever heard of that organization? It's a fantastic organization. They report news in countries where the free press is banned or not fully established by the government. And what they do is so important that people have been jailed or even hanged for accessing their content. We heard stories when we were working with them of people that live in countries like Uzbekistan that would illegally cross country lines to go to another country just to access a 2G connection on their feature phones, just to access the content of this site. They serve hundreds of millions of monthly page views. They serve 150 different sites over 60 countries. They're doing some really, really great things. But one thing that we knew from the start was that that couldn't be an option is to load up a page to wait 10, 20, 30 seconds to be able to access news. For this project, performance was literally a matter of life or death. People were dying over being able to access content too slow. So that means that our tools needed to change in how we worked on the project. We couldn't just rely on the same tools. We really need to make performance paramount to the project. So here we use a tool called Web Page Test. How many people use Web Page Test? This is like turning out to be the talk of surveys. How many people do this? If you haven't used Web Page Test, it's awesome. Webpagetest.org, it's a free service. What you do is you plug your URL into that text box and you click Start Test. And it gives you the results of how your site does from a performance standpoint. So this is slightly older. The interface has been updated a little bit more. But these are the results for my site. So they basically grade you. They say, you know, you failed on your first byte time. I can make the first byte time on my site a little bit better. My keep alive time is pretty good. I'm not compressing images very well, so they recommend some solutions on how to do that. And they basically tell you things like how long to your first byte time, how long to start render, how long to document complete, how long to fully loaded. They give you great stats like speed index, which I won't go over here, but everything in there is really, really valuable for building really fast performance sites. So for Radio Free Europe, basically what we decided to do was make a performance budget so that we knew what to target in our design and development process. So here's how you make a performance budget. It's pretty simple. You make a spreadsheet and you put the current site, right? So right now we use Radio Free Europe's mobile site, which they had. They had a mobile site and a desktop site, and our project was to make it all one site and make it responsive. And we just inventory the times using Web Page Test. So you plug the URL in, click start, and it just record the times in your spreadsheet. 4.193 seconds to start render, 5.65 seconds to visually complete, 7.9 seconds to fully loaded. And then what we did was we inventoried a bunch of their competitors. Now they're a new site, they don't really have competitors, but they had other organizations that they want to be a little bit more like. So we inventoried NPR and The Guardian and Al Jazeera and the BBC. And then what we did was we identified the fastest times. Now, coincidentally, their mobile site already was the fastest. So we could have stopped there and we could have said, well, your site is the fastest. As long as we don't break anything, you know, we're good. But my developer, Tim, on the project, he wrote this great post called Fast Enough. And he found a great stat that said people perceive tasks as faster or slower when there's at least a 20% time difference. So one of the things that we wanted to do was for people that regularly use the Radio Free Europe site, we wanted them to feel like the site was faster after this new redesign. So what we did was we took those initial times and then we just shaved 20% off of those times. And so those were our target times that we wanted to use. So rather than the site loading and starting to render at 4.193 seconds, we were shooting for 3.35 seconds. So those were our target times that we were going to use. Now, just a warning, it's going to get a little mathy in here. If you start to feel sick, you can stand up, you can take a breath, take some fresh air. Everybody good? Good? Anybody want to leave for a little? Okay. So there are 768 kilobits per second in the mobile speed that we were testing for. We're testing for 3G in web page testing. You can test for cable connections, DSL connections, 3G connections, whatever connection speed you want. Now, we don't measure bandwidth in terms of kilobits. We actually measure in kilobytes. So we need to do a little bit of a conversion. There are 8 bits in 1 byte, so that math tells us that there are 96 kilobytes per second in the speed that we're targeting. That gives us kilobytes instead of kilobits. So what we can do with that is we can actually target a page weight or a resource weight that we need. So we can say, if I want the site to start rendering in 3.35 seconds, I multiply it by my connection speed, and that means that site could be no more than 321 kilobytes for it to load or for it to start rendering in 3.35 seconds. You can do the same thing with visually complete, you can do the same thing with fully loaded, but now we have our target times. So let's look at how we use those in actually designing. Now we haven't designed or developed anything yet, but now we can use those to inform what we design. So check it out, let's take that first time, 321.98 kilobytes. If we spread that across the major resources that get downloaded by the browser, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, images, and web fonts, And we plot just the average weights of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. This comes from HTTP Archive. These are 2014 numbers. The average HTML page on the web is 60 kilobytes. The average CSS file on the web is 58 kilobytes, and the average JavaScript file is 298 kilobytes. We're already over budget. We're 91K over budget. So we can't make that site load in 3.35 seconds with these weights. So what can we do here? At this point, what I did was I talked to Tim and I said, hey Tim, what can we do about this? We're already over budget with the default weights. Not sure we can get our HTML and CSS down probably, but what can we do that's actionable? And he said, well, that number probably includes jQuery. And actually, I was thinking about doing this project without jQuery, just writing vanilla JavaScript and not doing any libraries on this. So what that meant was we could bring our target weight down, and for JavaScript, instead of 295 kilobyte, we could drop that down to 29K. That's what ours ended up being. And that gave us 175 kilobytes to play with. So if we divide that between images and web fonts, that actually tells you that you could do about four images. We've got about 87K for images and 87K for web fonts. It's about four images and six web fonts. Now if we pause for a minute, this tells us that we can design a homepage with, or any page of a site, with four images and six web fonts, and still get it to start rendering 3.35 seconds. For a designer, that is incredibly liberating. How many times have you designed something, it's the perfect thing, it's amazing, it's awesome, you show it to a developer who's the gatekeeper, and the developer's like, nah, man, can't do it. And then you have to try to strip out all the perfectness that you had in that comp. Designers embrace constraints. Designers do their best work under constraints. If you know before you start designing anything that you have four images and six web fonts to play with and you'll still meet your performance budget, that is incredible. And what I found was, okay, well maybe now you can start to budget like you were doing a financial budget. Well, I don't need six web fonts. I could probably do four. That would be great. And maybe I could have more images. So next time your CEO wants the carousel on the homepage, you can say, okay, cool, you can measure it with a performance button and say, actually, we can do that carousel on the homepage and still get that thing to load really quickly just by using these tools. Everybody good so far? All right, next type of inventory, visual inventory. I love making these. I don't know about you guys, but I'm going to confess something. I'm a designer. I've been designing for 15 years. The blank canvas scares the crap out of me. The blank sketchbook scares the crap out of me. The blank code editor scares the crap out of me. Starting design scares me. I always have way more questions than I have answers. And all of my clients hire me for answers, right? Like, they have a problem that they want solved, and they want me to be able to solve that. But I actually have more questions than they do before I start. So I have questions like, you know, is showing the app on a shiny laptop, is that the best way to sell it? Like, should we make that? Or can the brand pull off a minimalist design approach? Maybe that's the thing that we should do. Or maybe the copy should be more playful than professional, you know, I'm not sure. But I have hundreds and hundreds of questions. So what I do is, instead of starting in Photoshop, I start in a tool like Keynote. And, with PowerPoint, sorry, Microsoft. You can edit that, right?
Stick with Keynote.
So I make a blank Keynote document, and I take a screenshot of a website. And I do this really cool designer thing where I just crop some of the edges so it looks like I designed it. And then I write a small paragraph next to it. For example, how playful and whimsical should the new site be? The GoGo Squeeze site is full of smiles and kitschy illustrations that make you grin as you explore the site. And then if you keep your eye on the logo, the GoGo Squeeze logo, what I do is I just Photoshop in the client's logo. Right, so this is like CNN comes to you and they're like, we would love to be playful. And you're like, okay. You can spend 2 weeks doing a playful CNN comp, or you can spend 20 seconds taking a screenshot of a playful site and then Photoshopping their logo in. Remember the principle from the early part of this talk, high fidelity, shortest amount of time, come with a conversation. So rather than doing a playful CNN comp, I'll do what simulates a playful CNN comp and then have a conversation about it. Are these the shoes that you want to try on? Is this what you want to be? Does this feel appropriate for you? And they will likely say no, and I haven't wasted 2 weeks of designing a comp. I've wasted, you know, 2 minutes of screenshotting something and pasting it into a Keynote document. And what I find is all the questions that I have, like, should we do flat? You know, what do you guys like with color? Do you like flat? You know, should we do little color? Should we do monochromatic? What about the concept? Should it be a case study driven site? Or maybe the tone, should it be playful or professional? As you start to have these conversations and use this visual inventory, you start to narrow down choices. Now you have a starting point for what you should do with your site. Okay, well maybe they responded well to highly saturated and monochromatic sites, maybe they responded well to case study driven or human-centered narratives, and maybe they responded more positively to professional over playful. Now I have something to start with, I have something to work with that started with my questions. If you're interested in reading more about visual inventory, I wrote a post about it. I also have a template that you can download. I mean, it's easy enough to make on your own, but if you prefer to start start with a template. You can download a template there for Keynote and PowerPoint. Now, let's, again, take a step back. I'm talking about designer's inventory. We haven't even gotten to Photoshop and Sketch and Illustrator yet. I'm talking about using tools like Keynote or Excel to be able to make performance budgets and visual inventories. All of this kind of stuff is in the wheelhouse of what a modern designer should be doing. All right, good? All right, we're moving. Third part of the framework. I think designers should be sketching more. Now, pencil and paper, I don't mean that. That's really good too, but I want to show you a couple of different versions of how designers can be sketching. Probably my favorite way to sketch is with element collages. Now, I don't really sketch a lot in my sketchbook. I'm not a sketcher. I don't doodle, I don't do that stuff. I like to think in Photoshop, but I want to show you how I do that. Anybody know anything that's fundamental? Okay, a few people. Anybody remember if they went to elementary school in the US, there was this program where when you were in like second grade, you would read an amount of books, and depending on the amount of books that you would read, they'd give you a coupon for a personal pan pizza at Pizza Hut? Anybody remember that?
Yeah.
Yes! So that was Reading is Fundamental. They basically did that. And they called me a couple years ago and they said, you know, we need a new website because our current website is not accomplishing our mission. Now their mission is pretty simple. Their mission is to get books to kids who have never had books. That's it. They want to raise as much money as they can, and with all that money, they buy a ton of books, and with all those books, they give them to kids who've never had books. And the reason is because they've found ties between neighborhoods and areas of the cities that have low literacy and things like high crime and high poverty and a lot of welfare being doled out by the government and low graduation rates and low incomes. And what they found is that just by increasing literacy in a given area, they could reduce crime. They could reduce the amount of welfare that needs to be paid. They could raise income rates. They could raise graduation rates just by giving books to kids who've never had books. So that's their mission. It's pretty simple. And so this is a screenshot of my sketchbook, a photo of my sketchbook. My sketchbook is mostly a notebook. And what I did was, when we kicked off with them, I just let them tell us stories. And I just wrote down everything I could from their stories. And some things kept popping up, some things that they kept saying over and over again. Whenever they talked about their brand and what they did and what they do for the community, they used the word electric. They would say electric a lot. They would say words like shape, book, heart, and bubble. They would say words like visual book lists, and phrases like visual book lists and pages themed in books, and saying things like, you know, being able to let their audience turn the page for step two. And so what I did when I got home, I mean, we weren't scheduled to start design for a couple of weeks. We were helping them with some content strategy and architecture. But what I did was I just couldn't get these things out of my head. So I just created a Photoshop document, 2000 by 2000, and I just started to illustrate what these things could look like. So like, what does that phrase look like? Turn the page for step two. I started thinking about, well, maybe it's a button that when you roll over the button, it just like flips over like a book. And then I did another iteration of that. Well, maybe there's donation amounts that are suggested when you roll over. You know, what do visual book lists look like? Maybe kids and their parents could browse the site this way with like clusters of bookshelves, and maybe that's a way that they could kind of buy bundles of books or donate bundles of books to other kids. Maybe you can play up on nostalgia with people that have read Harry Potter and people that have, you know, remember Goldilocks and the Three Bears from when they were kids, and use that as sort of a compelling hook to donate. And what I found was it was really great for me to be able to turn phrases, powerful phrases, into visual hooks. And it was awesome for the client to hear their phrases, their energy, their thoughts about what they thought about their brand and their audience turned into pixels, like literally translated. I mean, there's no better way to show that you're listening to a colleague or to your boss or to a client than to turn what they've been thinking all along into actual pixels and show it back to them. So what I did was I then created a new Photoshop comp, and I just dragged some guys from 960 right down the screen. I just started to plot some of these things just on the page. And we did this whole project in the open. You can see every design deliverable that we've given to them. If you go to this site, you know, that URL at the bottom. And this is the first design deliverable, and we called it an element collage. It was a collage of elements that we were just designing for them. And it wasn't a web page. It was just like, if you took everything from their site, just put it all on one page, and you kind of squint at it, does it feel like the brand? Does it feel like Reading is Fundamental? So we showed them carousel elements and buttons. We showed them some typography studies. We showed them what a donation process might look like. We showed them what a book review could look like on their site. Now, at this point, we hadn't done any architecture. We didn't even know if book reviews were going to be on the site. But what we actually did through having the discussion about the element collage, it influenced the architecture discussions. How many times do we work on projects that are so waterfall? First we get requirements, then the requirements inform the architecture, then the architecture informs the design, and the design informs the developer. But when does a developer ever get to influence the strategy? One is the design and get to influence the architecture. If you flip that process around, you can get some really unconventional and some really great results. So what we were doing here was letting the design, letting the graphic design even, influence the architecture of the site as to what we were going to have. We had a great conversation about how they were going to do book reviews, if it was even possible, how it would work, where we'd pull info from. We looked at data visualization and putting cool icons on maps. And this was just fun for me as a designer, but it led to really, really great conversations with the client, strategy conversations, strategic conversations that we wouldn't have been able to have otherwise. And I got the best feedback from them about this. What they said was, you know, obviously this isn't a website, but I see how it could be one. And I think that's the perfect reaction to a modern design deliverable. We have to design for so many different screens, it is a zero-sum game to be able to design for every single one individually, right? We design from you know, iPhone 4, iPhone 5, iPhone 6, iPhone 6 Plus, all different resolutions, and all the Android phones, and big billboards, and desktops, and 27-inch iMacs, and all these different things. You can't do those one for one. So what you're asking your clients to do, what you're asking your colleagues to do, and your bosses, is you want them to look at something and go, now imagine what this looks like on a different form factor. And this, I think, is a great reaction. Yeah, it's not a website. You don't have to show me the website, but I can picture it in my mind. I can picture it on a desktop. I can picture it on a phone. I can picture it on a billboard. I can picture it wherever. The next project that I did was redesigning TechCrunch, which is a technology blog. And we did the same thing with them. We did an element collage. Now, they publish 80 to 100 articles a day, so one of the things that we did as part of that was really study typography and the color scheme, because the typography there was going to have to do a lot of heavy lifting for them. Now, I like to buy as many typefaces as I can, and my wife hates that, but I can't buy all the typefaces that I want. So I needed different tools than just Photoshop or Illustrator and just using the typefaces that I have and that I own. So for this one, we really leaned heavily on a tool called Typecast. Has anybody used Typecast before? Oh, it's fantastic. It was recently acquired by Monotype, and they just made it free. But Typecast basically pulls in fonts from all the different web services and lets you use them right in the browser. So you can set typefaces right in the browser using the combination of all these different libraries. And so we did all of our typography studies in Typecast. And we kind of did this back and forth between setting it in Typecast, screenshotting it back into Photoshop, and then from Photoshop back into Typecast, and just kind of doing this dance between where are we going to figure out the typography combinations. And we did a bunch of iterations on this and ultimately nailed down the typographic hierarchy that we're going to have for the site that made reading easy, that made it very legible across devices. We showed them things like interaction states of how the share buttons might work. We showed, you know, clusters and sort of this breaking news, how that kind of fit with their brand. We showed them, you know, sort of what a headline view versus an expanded view would look like. We did this kind of irreverent tag cloud that was just super gigantic and you know, really kind of offensive in the way that their brand is. We showed them different devices and different treatments for recirculation. And all of these were sort of covered in the element collage. Now, one of the things that I love about doing projects in the open and writing about things like element collages, you know, I wrote about it for Reading is Fundamental, and a great agency in the UK called Clear Left, they decided to start using element collages in there as part of their design framework. And what they did was, and what they found was a problem with element collages, where they would show, like, this is an example of an element collage that they showed to a client. And the client said, this looks great, you know, we love this, but what happens when you click on the icons here? And what that meant was they weren't really getting that this wasn't a web page, right? This is supposed to be a collage, but can you blame them? I mean, modern web pages kind of look like this nowadays. So what they started to do instead of doing their element collages vertically, they started to do them horizontally. And that completely eliminated the conversation of like, well, what happens when I click on this? Or, you know, it was much, much more clear that this is a collection of elements, this is an element collage, rather than a website or a piece of a website. And it's such an obvious idea, but I never would have thought of it had they not done this and had they not written about it. So the next project I did was to redesign Entertainment Weekly's mobile site, and I used the same approach there. Our element collage was horizontal, and never once did we have the conversation about, well, is this a website, or what actually is this? It wasn't an abstraction. It was a literal thing where they could see all of the elements from their site kind of splayed out on one page, and we had conversations about everything from photographic credit to typographic hierarchy to color schemes to interactions all through this deliverable. And I talked to Paul Lloyd, who was a designer at Clear Left at the time and worked at The Guardian, and he said, like, you know that point where you're in Photoshop and right before you send something to a client or to your boss, you turn off a bunch of layers, you just turn off the visibility and then before you save it out? He's like, well, element collage is kind of like giving your client a peek at those little layers. Right? It's all the things. The things that you're wondering about, it's the things that you're not sure about. It like lets your client and your boss in on your design process, in on that conversation. All right, so you might be thinking, all element collages and style tiles and all that stuff are all well and good, but why not just design this stuff in the browser? Like, why not just do it in that environment? And I have a couple issues with that. The first issue that I feel is that when some people say designing in the browser, sometimes what they mean is just skip design. And I think that's okay in some respects, because in some ways, you can skip the graphic design part and do that stuff in the browser. You don't need a graphic editor to do that. But when you're skipping the rendering of intent part, like if you're trying to figure something out, sometimes you don't have the fluency in the browser to be able to do that. And I don't think that that's a piece that can be skipped. If you're sketching, if you're not sketching and you're building, then you've skipped the step. You know, the other thing related to that is when people say, well, designers should just learn to code. Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that's a great skill, but it often is the same as designers should become developers. And that's great when you're talking about graphic design, but it doesn't work as well when you're talking about skipping that kind of rendering of intent phase. And I guess the last thing is that, you know, when I just see sites that are designed in the browser, they just kind of look designed in the browser. You know what I mean? All right, tough crowd. But like, I don't blame anybody for that. That's not a developer's fault. That's not designer's fault. It's the fault of our tools, right? So think about how we work, right? We have this code editor. We pick our nice colors for code hinting, and we type line, and we hope, and we jack in the box, and we refresh the browser, and oh, that's not exactly what we're doing. So then we go back and we compile our code, and we do the same thing, and then we hope for it, and we compile it, and it's not exactly right, and you got a bug. And that is not a really great example of how we should create. I'm going to show you a great talk by Brett Victor. And he talks about kind of the problem with this, and so he talks about it way better than I would, so have a listen.
Creators need an immediate connection with their creating. That's my principle. Creators need an immediate connection with what they create. And what I mean by that is, when you're making something, if you make a change, you make a decision, you need to see the effect of that immediately. There can't be a delay, and there can't be anything hidden. Creators have to be able to see what they're doing. So now I'm going to show you a series of cases where I noticed that principle is violated, and I'll show you what I did about that. And then I'm going to talk about the larger context which I do this with. So to begin with, let's think about coding. Here's how coding works. You type a bunch of code into a text editor, kind of imagining in your head what each line of code is going to do. And then you compile and run, and something comes out. So in this case, it's just JavaScript drawing through Canvas, and it draws this little scene with a tree. But if there's anything wrong with the scene, or if I want to make changes, if I have further ideas, I have to go back to the code. And I edit the code, compile and run, see what it looks like. Anything wrong, I go back to the code. Most of my time is spent working in the code, working in a text editor blindly, without an immediate connection to this thing, which is what I'm actually trying to make. So I feel this goes against this principle I have, that creators need an immediate connection they're making. So I tried to come up with a coding environment that I thought might be more in line with this principle I have. So what I have here is I've got this picture on the side, and the code on the side, and this part draws the sky, this draws the mountains, this draws the tree. And when I make any change to the code, the picture changes immediately. So the code and the picture are always in sync. There's no compile and run. I just change things in the code, and I see things change in the picture. And now that we have this immediate connection between the code and the picture, we can start thinking about ways of changing the code other than typing. So for example, this number here is the length of the branches. If I want to control that number, I just point my mouse to it, hold down the control key, and I can dial it up and down. So I can see what it looks like for big branches or small branches, and I can kind of converge on what feels right to me artistically. And this works for any number of the code. I just point to it, dial it up and down. And some of these numbers here, I know what they do, but it's still kind of surprising to see them do it. And other ones are just completely surprising. So down here, I've got this for loop where I'm counting to 16. I'm putting 16 little pink blossoms on every branch. and I can turn that down for less blossoms or turn it up for more. But look at what I'm doing here. I'm just kind of moving that number up and down around 20 or so. And it has this really interesting shimmering effect. It kind of looks like the wind is blowing through the tree. And the first time I saw this, I immediately started thinking about how I could use this effect for an animation. How would I ever have discovered that if I had to compile and run between every change? So much of art, so much of creation is discovery. And you can't discover anything if you can't see what you're doing.
Did you catch that point? How would I ever have discovered that animation idea if I had to compile and run every time I made a change? So much of creation is about discovery, and you can't discover anything if you can't see what you're doing. For me, when I think about designing in the browser, I think about it more this way. Instead of talking about designing in the browser, what about deciding in the browser? Right? Rather than thinking of them as binary, why not think of them as a spectrum or as a continuum? A lot of us think where Photoshop is where all the decisions are made, and then code is where they're implemented. But instead, Photoshop can be where ideas are started, and the browser could be where those ideas are finessed. Or vice versa, the browser could be where those ideas are started, and then Photoshop is the place where those ideas can be finessed. So the browser could be a place where you decide, or Photoshop could be a place where you decide. I don't feel like they're mutually exclusive. Let's talk a little bit about prototyping, and I think it's possible to design in the browser, but it might look a little bit different than what you might think. So let me show you a little bit about what prototyping would be. I did a project a few years ago for a small organization you guys probably never heard of. And I worked with my friend Jamie Kasoy. And one of the things that I love about Jamie is that I think he knows how to prototype really, really well. So I'm going to show you what his guidelines are for prototyping. So he has these guidelines. The first one is that each prototype must take less than 1 hour to make. If you're spending more than an hour prototyping, you're not prototyping, you're building something. Right? So it's not a prototype, it's not a sketch. The second guideline is that the first prototype should be something that anyone can build. We'll come back to that one. The third one is build ugly. So let me show you what build ugly actually looks like. These are comps from the agency that I used to work at called Big Spaceship. And on the right, you see what the comp is. This is for a site that was built in Flash for Corona Beach. And on the left is a fully functioning, working prototype. Right, the arrows move, the text works. How many people here have used Flash before? Okay, for those of you who have never used Flash, text usually sizes to the box that it's in. So to get that E to wrap is a masterful work of art like that. That is an intentional design decision for a prototype. Now the reason for this decision is that, you know, when you're building something and you build it close enough, like 90% there, you're like, oh, I'll come back to this and I'll polish it later. And then you never come back to it and you never polish it later. Right? You just say, I just launch with it, it's fine, I'll fix it. You can't launch the thing on the left. It's working, it's fully functioning, but you have to come back to that to apply the graphics, to do the animation, to get the text just right, to get the pixel, to get your pixel perfection. You have to come back to it. Here's another example. Comp on the right, fully functioning prototype on the left. And probably my favorite example, comp on the right, fully functioning working prototype on the left. Okay. So we did this project for this small organization. And when Jamie and I were brainstorming, the creative direction that we came up with was, we're going to let people see this product from all angles. Right? That was the brunt of the project. And so we did our sketches. So we came up with that together, we brainstormed together. I went off and I did my sketches, and Jamie went off and he did his sketches. This is my sketch. I wrote the copy, I had this image. I didn't know if this is the right thing yet, but it was just a thing that I did in an hour, just put a couple things together to see how it felt, see if it felt like the right direction. This was Jamie's sketch. This was in the browser. This is a lime green box. It's a div, had a background color of lime. It was whatever, had a width and a height. And this is the first prototype. Now remember the guideline. The first prototype should be something that anyone can make. So this is the first one. And this was the second one. Playing with CSS transforms in the browser. This is the third one. Adding another face. This is the fourth one. Adding a third face to make it look a little more 3D. And what Jamie's doing here is he's establishing a breadcrumb trail for himself, and more importantly, for any other developer that hops onto the project late. So maybe where we end up is something that not every developer can do. But by looking at prototype 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, you kind of see his train of thought. Like, this is way better than Git history. You can see all of these things in sequence and understand how he got from one point to another. The next couple of set of prototypes, he moved into an environment called CodePen. And he started playing with what the animation would kind of look like. The next prototype, if you keep your eye on the HTML box, he tried to figure out what would happen if we generated all of that code with JavaScript instead of doing it in HTML, see if that had any performance benefits or if that had any drawbacks. And at this point, he shared with me, you know, his 12 or 13 prototypes. And I was like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing here. You're literally letting people see this thing from every angle. Like maybe you could see the bottom and the top and the, you know, and it was like a configurator thing that we were doing. So then this was my sketch. This is my next sketch, because I was riffing off of what he was doing. And what we're doing here is we're kind of playing off of each other's sketches, where I see what he's doing, and I do a revision, then he sees what I'm doing, and I do a revision. And we're sort of sketching at the same time, just in our different mediums. So he saw this sketch, and then he started moving into something like this. And what he started to do here was really great, is he started to write these problem and solution statements, right? These things underneath each prototype. Each prototype is designed to do one thing and one thing only. It takes less than an hour to build. He just wants to test out an idea. So in this one, using a div in the DOM. In this one, what happens if we make it an anchor tag and make it clickable and put an animated gif in it, click the square. This one, combining 3.js library with a custom CSS primitive. This one was, what happens if we texture map that thing? The next thing, what if we test 3.js's trackball controls and you can sort of drag the thing around and kind of spin it around? The next prototype, playing with the depth, got this really weird result. It kind of looks like a lunch tray sort of thing. Next prototype, gummy, ooh, weird. And we don't know if we're going to use these things, but we're just sort of playing with some of the things that we can do. We're sketching. Next prototype, sway. Next one, what if we use the textures in the comp? What does that change on all of these things? Next prototype, rollover extension. So what happens if we sort of play with these things in 3D space? Next prototype, add a little sway back in and still have the rollover extensions. Now this is an important point in the prototyping process because at this point, Jamie's done maybe about 70 prototypes. And here, he's now combining two of them together. We add the sway with the rollover extensions. And at this point, what he's starting to do is starting to combine the prototypes. So he's done about 70 individual ones. What happens if we combine prototype number 2 with prototype number 15? What about number 8 with number 21? What about number 12 with number 13? And then what happens if we combine two prototypes together, and then 4 prototypes, and then 8, and then 12, and then 15, and 20, and then 50, and then 100 prototypes? What we found is we actually build the site, right? Because we build them on all these little independent containers. And as we put them together, we start to realize how they interact. And you built the whole site because you planned it well enough. We'll come back to that in just a minute, but let's recap. I'm talking about designer sketching, and I'm not talking about pencil and paper or even Photoshop, Sketch, and Illustrator. Those are great tools to use, but what about sketching in Typecast? What about sketching in CodePen? What about sketching with HTML5? What do those things actually look like as sketch tools? And what if you're making element collages and prototypes and all of those kinds of things as part of the design toolkit? The fourth part, and this relates to what we just talked about, and this is the easiest part, is that designers assemble. That's the last part. That's the easiest thing to do. In all of our projects, in our web projects, we spend the most time assembling, and it's because we haven't figured out what we're doing. We didn't plan well enough. We didn't sketch well enough. We didn't inventory well enough. If we do those things well enough, assembly becomes the easy part. There's this really great concept in cooking called mise en place. And the idea is, when you're trying to make a dish, it literally stands for everything in its place. And the idea is that when you're trying to make a dish, you prep all the ingredients first. Any good chef in any kitchen will do that, right? They'll chop the onions, they'll shred the cheese, they'll make sure they have their corn, they make sure they have the salt, they make sure they have all the ingredients there, ready, prepped for service. And then, when you go to cook the chicken, you put the chicken in the pan, a minute later you put your onions in, a minute later you put your garlic, a minute later you put something else. If you put your chicken in the pan and then you go to chop the onions, you burn your chicken. So don't burn your chicken on West Project, not me. So how do we apply mise en place to our work? Well, if we plan well enough, if we sketch well enough, if we inventory well enough, the assembly should be the easy part. Here's an example of how you can assemble. Adobe came out with this great feature called Creative Cloud Libraries in one of the latest updates. This was when I was designing for Radio Free Europe. We planned, we inventoried, we sketched, and I designed all of the little pieces that we need. So when I needed to design a mobile comp of a page, literally 30 seconds. I need the edit, drag it in. I need the comment thread, drag it in. I need the comments, the calendar, drag it in. I need a large story, I need a small story, comp done, 30 seconds. Move on to the next one. Because we've done all the work in advance, the assembly part is easy. Making the comp takes 30 seconds. Planning for the comp takes a couple of weeks. if you prefer code, there are tools for that too. So one great tool is called Pattern Lab, built by my friend Brad Frost. And the idea behind Pattern Lab is that you break down a website into all of its atomic elements. And so an atom might be something like an H1 or a paragraph. And a molecule might be when you combine those two things, like when you combine a text box and a button, you get a search field. And when you combine more molecules together, you get organisms, like a comment field. And when you combine organisms together, you create templates. And when you put content in those templates, you get pages. So if you break them down into their atomic elements, then you have the system of assembly that you can use in code with includes to basically put them all together. That Radio Free Europe project that I mentioned, we knew that we were going to use Pattern Lab, and so we did all of our work in Google Docs. And we wrote down, you see the tabs at the bottom, atoms, molecules, organisms, presets. We added all of the atoms there, and we started to have discussions cell by cell with the client about, well, should this be an atom? Should this be a molecule? Should this be an organism? Well, maybe this organism is the same as this one. Maybe we can combine these two. And we worked out all of the things that we needed to do in the Google Doc. And then once it came down to designing it, it was easy. Because we already had all the hard work done. We just needed to assemble all of those pieces. So assembly is the easiest part of this thing. You can use things like Creative Cloud or Pattern Lab and put those kind of things together. So let's kind of recap as we're closing out here. Before, when you think of a designer, well, designers do comps, right? That's what they're supposed to do. But now what I'm saying is a designer can do all these things. Write manifestos and make prototypes and do pattern labs and visual inventories. From a tool standpoint, you can expand this from just Photoshop and Sketch and Illustrator to all sorts of things, HTML5 and CodePen and Notational Velocity and Google Docs. These are all designer's tools. Now, if you look at this, you might say, well, wait a minute, like Dana, aren't you trying to just make designers more like developers, or make designers more like content strategists, or make more like whatever? And the answer is, yeah, sort of. Because if you can do that, then you can have better conversations, and you can have more empathy for how your colleagues work and how you can work better. I want to show you an example of that. This is Michael Jackson, for those of you that don't know. He didn't play any instruments, but he understood them intrinsically. So here's a clip, take a listen, here's a clip of him writing Beat It. This is like one of the earliest kind of sketches of Beat It. He sings the lead vocal, he overdubs the bass, the minor percussion, the backing vocals. Just take a listen, it's amazing.
This is the harmonies. Vocal harmonies on the choruses. Beat It. I'll do the verses, then I'll do the choruses.
Demonstrating empathy. He wasn't a bass player, but he knew what the bass needed to do. He was not a guitar player, but he knows what the guitar needs to do, to the point where he knows how he can write those parts, he can sing those parts, he can overdub those parts. It's empathy for what other people are doing and how he was going to work with them, and that's what made him one of the greatest musicians of all time. What I'm saying is it's reinvention. It's not reinvention, it's evolution. I'm not asking you to reinvent yourself. I'm asking you to evolve. I think we live in a different world and people access the internet from devices that fit in the palm of their hands all the way to giant billboards and everything in between. Remember Stephanie from before? She didn't reinvent herself, she evolved. You might not know her as Stephanie Germanotta anymore, but you probably know her as one of the best-selling artists of all time. That's Lady Gaga. She used the same tools, vocals, musical ability, but she added more to help her expand her output. So my challenge to you, expand your tools, expand your output. Now you know what to make. Thank you.